Good afternoon, everyone. In case you haven't heard, I am Richard Hull, and I have the pleasure today to be the moderator for some comments by Rachel Tour on my far right and Danielle Stevens on my near right, whose comments no doubt need moderating. That's why they call me the moderator. Now, our session here is brainstorming academic publishing issues. We're going to focus chiefly on journal articles and monographs, the sorts of things that if you could find a still existing university publisher, you might want to publish there. I'm going to start out with three or four questions in common and let each of them comment. But this is a session that is yours as well as mine. So jump in. If you have a question, rather than asking it, wave your hand, and I will run over. This is my exercise period, thank you, Paul. And I will run over, and we will get you on tape for eternity. Okay, let's start out with one of the most common worries, particularly of early publishers. How do editors generally view those seeking to publish their first journal article or book? Are they wary of new authors? Are they welcoming and nurturing of them? Rachel, how about book editors?
What I tell people, you know, about when I was in, and this, it's kind of hard, this I think might be hard for authors to believe, but when I was an editor, I was characterologically interested in everything. So if somebody came up to me at a conference and said, oh, I'm working on a project about this, and it was even vaguely connected to an area that I would be publishing in, I would say, oh, great, send it to me. And I really meant it. I mean, I think as editors, as book editors, we're always really hungry for something that's going to be fabulous. And often when people are talking about their work, it sounds great. You know, and then what makes it into the manuscript is sometimes a different story. I would say as an editor, and most all of the editors that I know are extremely eager and often thrilled to go to a conference and talk to different people about their work. That's my experience.
Danielle, I'm a green PhD looking, already worrying about tenure and so forth, and looking for some journal to publish something out of my dissertation. What would you advise me to do? Can I call you? Can I have your home number?
Well, writing from your dissertation is classically a challenge, I think, because the audience of a dissertation is a very different audience than the audience that is reading in journal articles. So not that the work that's in a dissertation is invaluable, but that it has to be changed so much and transformed so much and shortened so much to make a journal article out of it, it takes a lot of work. It's not a bad idea, but it's going to take quite a bit of work. And sometimes at that point, many doctoral students or people are tired of their dissertation and weary of the work that they've put into it, and they need some distance from it. So I wouldn't discourage you, but I currently have a group at Portland State of people who are trying to get their dissertation. They're actually hired as faculty, and now they want to publish their dissertation, and they find it difficult to do that. And would you agree with that, Rachel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything harder than starting a new faculty job and at the same time having to go back to what you did as a student and revise it and turn it into a book, which nobody ever told you really how to turn a dissertation into a book, and they're very different kinds of things. And so coupled with teaching you know, a bunch of new classes and trying to do all that. I mean, I think it's really, really difficult. And different institutions support to better and less degrees faculty members on, you know, on being able to negotiate that.
So that's a little discouraging, I'm sure, because people who have written their dissertations have spent a lot of time with it and a lot of work with it. And plus, it's a negotiated text. It's a text that's been negotiated with three other people or four other people that are on your committee. In some ways, it's not as authentic as your own voice or your own work. So you can call me. I'll work with you on it. And maybe we can, actually, as you said, I can work with people on that, but I don't, yeah. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Well, this actually raises in my mind a prior question, and that is, when can a graduate student start publishing?
I tell graduate students they should try to publish anything they write in graduate school.
Is that legitimate? Is that
sure? If you can get it published, you should get your stuff out there. You should get feedback. You should. I had a graduate student have a very good comprehensive paper. I said, go out and try to publish it, and she did, and she uses it now as part of her tenure package. So I say you try to publish everything, anything you write in grad school, because it gets you into that process of preparing your manuscript for publication, of thinking about where you're going to locate it. You're going to get some feedback, and there's layers of feedback that help, you know, so, yep.
Dr. Elaine Hull is a neuroscientist who I have some passing acquaintance with, and she was recently telling me about one of her students who has been encouraged to publish a prelim paper that she wrote for prelims. Is that common? Is that what is that unique? Let me get over here now.
Here's your exercise time.
I think it is not terribly common, but I know when I was reading it, I thought that this would be a good thing for her to try to publish. And furthermore, the faculty member on her committee who had asked that particular question, which had to do with the role of testosterone in combating stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. The brain mechanisms whereby it might work.
Yeah.
He was the one that specifically raised the issue during her prelims, mm-hmm. during her defense, and said, you know, this was very well done. I would like for you to add a little bit more. And so she did write another several pages. But we are now in the process of publishing that with him as a co-author and me and actually one of his students who's doing her dissertation on that.
Yeah, and I remember in grad school I had written a paper on comparing Vygotsky and Piaget. I'm in ed psych. And I took it to a faculty member and he said, oh, nobody will read that. And I was thinking, they would have. Because it's a helpful kind of, I mean, it's a very helpful comparison to make between the two. And he just said, but he didn't write, so it's
did
probably. So maybe I shouldn't have taken his opinion.
Can you ask your question just to identify yourself?
I'm Susan Skidmore. I did publish off of my prelims also. I published an article.
Great.
But you had mentioned about publishing anything in grad school, but if you're doing a journal article dissertation, I know that varies by discipline. Yes. I think maybe I'm not close enough to it. Oh, is that better? If you're doing a journal article dissertation, I know in the sciences there's differences.
Yeah,
but
I don't know the sciences. So maybe Dr.
That was my question. What do you advise graduate students then if they're going to, if they want to publish their work in graduate school, but then if they can't use it for their journal article dissertation if they publish it?
When I was a director of graduate studies, I encouraged students in the first year in graduate school to make what I call the professional turn. Stop writing for the professor and start writing for the professorate, for the journals. Make everything you write a potential contribution for a journal. I had one student who took that to heart, and he wrote, I think it was a five-chapter dissertation. Each half chapter was an article, and he assembled the dissertation by stapling the articles together, almost literally. Not he had to fit the graduate school requirements, but he certainly got the idea.
My name is Brittany Rosine. I'm from Texas A&M University, and I'm just finished my second year as a doctoral student. And at Texas A&M, I'm in the health education division, and they highly, highly recommend us to do what we call dissertation by publication. And so you kind of already know what you're doing before you really start collecting your data. And basically what you do is, you know, you get publications towards your dissertation. Like right now I'm working on a systematic literature review, and before I even finish my dissertation I'll have publications. And what And you can do that because I think it's our master, no, our thesis and dissertation. What's that called? Yes, thank you. Thesis office will go to the journal and specifically ask for those rights in order to publish it for our dissertation.
Right.
And so that's how that's done.
If I can just jump in here, are there people in the humanities here, or is it mostly science, social science? Because so this might not be a big issue for you, but in the humanities, I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing about from publishers a lot is if something's already available, so if you write a dissertation and it's available online, which basically all of them are, you can embargo it for a certain amount of time, then what's the incentive to publish that? One of the things that I think, a lot of my friends, are being told, you're not writing a thesis, you're writing a book. And I think that's, in some ways it's good advice, and in other ways it's problematic, because the thesis is for a very small group. It's for a readership of, three or five, and a book has to be for more. But if you write that, if you write your thesis as a book, and then you try and get it published, some publishers will say, no, because it's a small enough audience that anybody who really wants it can get it. It's already available.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And so this is something, really a big problem in fields like history. And a friend of mine just, last month defended his PhD. He defended his dissertation, and he already had a contract from a university press to publish it based on a couple of chapters, which is great news. But I keep saying to him, you have to make sure that the book is going to be described really differently, so that the scope is big enough that libraries aren't going to look at it and say, we already have access to it. And so I think that's just something that, that's one of the ways in which publishing is changing, because things are available electronically now and are considered published, even if they're not published by book publishers.
I've got a draft of an article or a book, and I'm now trying to decide where to send it. How do I decide where to send my article or my book?
Okay, I usually, first of all, I think it's very important to have done some sort of an annotated bibliography of the key journals in your area, so that you know the 10 or 15 that are in your subject area, something about their rejection rate, which you can get from Cabell's on a database. They have a rejection rate. In education, we have like 2,500 journals. So my students, you should be able to figure out where to put things, but you got to look at the rejection rate. Then the other thing I do is I always say you need to have the stretch journals, you need to have the reach journals, and then you need the fallback journals. So the first time you send something out, you send it out to the stretch journal, the most highly regarded journal in the field, which you should know from your faculty members. Even now, you can talk about most highly regarded journal in your field. And you talk to them and find out which ones those are, and then those are your stretch. And then you have the reach that probably may not be listed. Like I'm on the editorial board of a journal called Reflective Practice. It is not in the SSCI list. But it's probably a reach journal. A fallback would be something that's a little lighter weight, might have advertisements in it. Who knows? Like in education, it might be Ed Leadership or CAPAN, one of those. So, or their practitioner journals. So you choose those, and then you can decide where does your text fall. And that one of the nicest things to do is to make a folder, I think, and to put that list of journals. The first one, your stretch, then your reach, and then fall back. And if the stretch rejects it totally, look at it, look at their advice, make some changes. Don't hold on to it too long, and send it out. Because if you do hold on to it too long, it won't get sent out. That's my philosophy.
How about my book manuscript?
I was at a conference not too many years ago that was populated with law professors and journalism professors who write law, which is more me. And one of the things that came out of that would be finishing your sentence, I would say, which is, but also be aware of whom you're trying to impress
that's going to impress them.
The vast majority of the people in the room at that point were very clear that they knew what the most prestigious law reviews were around the country. And yet I might be, for some purposes, preferring to publish in a much lesser prestige journal, knowing that if it's got the word Harvard or Yale in the title or something of that ilk, my dean's going to be more impressed with that than with Tulane Law Review. And you know, so I'll go to the lesser journal that specializes in what I do, even if I know it's lower prestige, knowing that my dean will be more impressed by that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, too, is law the only entity where all the games are on our side because we get to send to as many places we want as one, and then it's just like playing like a sports figure deciding which team to sign with?
I think you're the only discipline where the students make the decisions.
Well, that's true, too. And some deans don't care.
Yeah, good follow-up question. Can you send this article to multiple journals?
Not journal article. Nope. You must send to one journal at a time.
How long do I give them?
3 months.
Why just
And then three? You send them an email, and the email says, what is the status of my manuscript? It's kind of a non-offensive, but it's a little bit of a, I'm concerned about this. And that tends to, oh yeah, I've gotten in 2 reviews. And then the editor, you know, goes out after the third one. Or if you are in the position of going up for tenure or you're going up for review and you really need that manuscript, you need to know the status of that manuscript, then you actually tell the editor that. You tell the editor, you know, can you kind of scooch this along a little faster? I need to have this information sooner rather than later because I'm going. And usually they've been sympathetic to that, you know. As a reviewer, people will come to me and say, Danelle, when are you going to get this review back to me so that, you know, that helps us all be a little more responsive. Any other comments on that from the audience? I saw some nods. Am I saying it right? This is my experience. I see nods around, so I really haven't talked to too many people about this, you know, but it seems to me like that's my experience.
And when I was an editor, I would always tell authors, you know what, if you don't hear from me in what feels like a reasonable amount of time, nag me. I mean, and I don't really want them to nag me, but a short, polite email that just says, hey, I'm just wondering, because sometimes, you know, you forget about things, or they fall to the bottom of a pile, and it's really, often it's the really nice people who get abused and neglected because they're patient and they're waiting. But really, you don't have to, I mean, unless it's, you know, been 2 weeks and you're like, excuse me, I haven't had a, you know, response from you yet, then that's obnoxious. But waiting for a couple of months and then just checking in, it never bothered me to have people just say, hey, what's going on? Sometimes it was just a little bit of a nudge for me to go like, oops, I forgot about that. Or, oops, I haven't heard from the reader. And so I'm going to call the readers and say, hey, did you, what about this? And they're like, oops, I forgot. So you don't want to be the oops person who, you know, keeps getting neglected because you're too nice.
Well, one time I had a manuscript. It was in 6 months to this journal. And I had talked to a colleague who publishes a lot. And he said, too long, 3 months, give him a little, ask him about it. And so then I did, and they said, oh, we had a new editorial board, and we don't know, you know, we're in flux right now, and we're not sure how. I said, well, how long do you think it's going to take? Oh, another 3 months. I said, I'm pulling it. I am pulling the manuscript. I'm going to send it to somebody else. I can't wait 3 more months. 6 months, I've already waited. So I did, and I got it published. But that sometimes that's what's going on. So you want to, you know, kind of stay in touch with them.
Well, I've waited my requisite 3 months, and then I've contacted the editor, and I've waited another 3 months, and then I get rejected.
Right.
Now, I get rejected. That's the way it feels. Right. How do I translate that feeling into a fact that can be productive and something I can deal with? Rachel?
I think, you know, it's what Daniel was saying, was having a reasonable list of places to send it to. And I think having, I mean, and it's really hard with book manuscripts because 3 months is not going to get you an answer usually. It can take up to a year for the review process to really work and go through to get a contract. And so I think part of it is, and book publishing is different because it goes through different stages. You know, and I mean, if I knew how to deal with rejection, I'd be a happier person. You know, I mean, I know we all do get rejected. And I think, you know, when I was an editor, the president of Oxford University Press, I was really upset because I had lost a book. You know, I was trying to give somebody a contract, and they turned me down to go to, like, Basic Books or something. And I was really upset. And he said, you know, if you're not occasionally losing projects, you're not reaching hard enough. You know, you're not going for the things that are going to really test you as an editor to be able to bring something in. So I think that, you know, I don't know how to deal with rejection. I think what you do is you just focus on the work, and then you send it out again, and you know exactly where to send it out. And I think there are different, I think you might be following up with this question, but there are different kinds of rejects, you know, different kinds of rejection letters. And there's the, you know, the flat, you know, form reject, which usually doesn't look like a form. You know, it looks like it's actually a letter to you, but it's really not. It's a form. You know, so I have friends who call me up and say, hey, I got this letter, you know, and they read it to me, and I'm like, form reject. You know, it's a nice form reject, but it's a form reject. But anything that you can glean from the process is only going to help you for the next submission.
And the other thing is that there's levels of rejection in journal manuscripts. First of all, you send it to the editor. And if you get an answer back in a couple of weeks, the editor said, mm-mm, doesn't fit our journal, not a good place, not a good match. And it didn't even go out to the reviewers at all. So, and then sometimes what I've done is I've where do you think it would be good to submit this idea? And so you write them, sometimes they'll answer you, sometimes they won't. But it's a good idea to say, if you know, do you have another, they know the field, they know the journals, they know where this might fit better. Maybe it's fit. Maybe it doesn't match the kind of things they're doing. Maybe it's a topic, say, active learning in a science classroom, and they just are preparing a theme journal about that, and the journal's filled. And they don't need another article on that topic. It has nothing to do with your article. It may be that they are producing a theme, and they may tell you that, but I would suggest that you know, find out a little bit more about what's going on with it.
And I think, I mean, really important is making sure, I mean, exactly that you're submitting to the right places, because
right.
The easiest letter to write as an editor is, this doesn't fit with our list. You know, we don't publish books in this area. And that's something you should have figured out before you submitted it. And you can figure that out by looking at the catalog, you know, everything's online, or by even, you know, checking in with the editor and saying, you know, querying them and saying, is this the kind of thing you'd be interested in? And I think editors, you know, tend to be pretty, well, overworked and underpaid, but also often very generous if they see promise in something. And so often, you know, I would say, you know, this isn't for me, but try, you know, Naomi Schneider at University of California Press, or, you know, try Kate Wittenberg at Columbia, or, you know, somebody else who I think would be interested in it. By the same token, as an editor, I sometimes lied to protect the feelings of the author by saying things like, you know, I've discussed this with my colleagues, and we've decided it's not appropriate for us. Well, I didn't really discuss it with my colleagues, but it just seemed softer than taking all the responsibility myself. You know, but so, I mean, so that's the thing. There's no obligation to tell you the truth of their process, right? So I think...
But I have another strategy to deal with that. One of the things, in particular with books, is that I am a member of the American Educational Research Association. They have a huge conference, 10,000 people every year, 1,000 sessions. And about 10 years ago, I started spending a whole day in the exhibitions, the book expeditions. Exhibitions. Anyway, and it was an expedition in the process. And I would just go around from booth to booth, and I was gathering data. What kind of books are they publishing about this topic? What other kind of books are there? What kind of appeal do they have? And I would just, I'd buy them sometimes, sometimes not. And then I would begin to talk to acquisitions editors. Say I have an idea. I have this idea about a book. Might this be something you're interested in? And we have actually edit publishers. Are you, your publisher's here. Is this something that sounds familiar? Authors come up to you and they go, like the rubrics book, I went up to John von Noring, a stylist, and I said, I'm thinking of writing a book about rubrics. Is this something you're interested in? He'd go, well, what's a rubric? So then I finally had to persuade him what is a rubric and how valuable it is, etc. And gradually, that is a really important part of your data gathering. And it's also part of talking, of having a pitch about your work. Talking about your work, they'll ask you questions about your work. They'll ask, well, what does this mean? And why are you doing this? And who would want to be interested in this? And so I do that every conference. I spend at least a half a day. Yeah.
I would offer that rejection is what co-authors are for. First, you've got somebody else to blame. And secondly, you've got somebody to write that flame email to that you really mean for the editor, but you don't dare.
That was Steve Gillen, just for the record. Okay, so I've
you had a comment to make a while ago. Oh, a question. Okay.
And this may be taking into your next question anyway, because I know that one of the things you wanted to talk about was if it's not reject, but it's revise and resubmit in some way. Is it ever worth a author's or hopeful author's time to look so carefully at the two or three reviewers' comments, assuming that they were helpful but contradictory, and to ask for the editor's backing in advance, you know, to make clear, and instead of going blindly with what may be a form revise and resubmit letter, saying, editor, let's take a moment together and look at what you've sent. How much are you behind this project? Because what I think I'd like to do is spend time addressing this, and telling you why this really shouldn't be addressed. Can we deal with that up front instead of having me spend the weeks that it would take me to do this and then find out that wasn't matching what you had in mind?
Are you talking about books or journal articles?
Okay. Well, I did get a great suggestion from the TAA newsletter when they talked about revise and resubmit, and she said put, and I'm a charts and tables person, you know, think of rubrics, you know. But I also wrote a book on journal keeping, so I'm kind of both yin-yang kind of brain. But anyway, I just take every single comment and I put it in a little box and I leave space on the side to figure out exactly how I'm going to address that. And if they're contradictory, I'll say, I'm going to choose this one. I like this one better. It makes more sense to me and this is why. Editors have told me that if you send that back with your revision, your rationale, that they can see exactly the kind of changes you're making and they can isolate why you thought the way you thought, and then go from there. I think that's
totally one of my articles that I sent to a journal of medicine and philosophy, which had reviewers that were MDs and philosophy PhDs. And I got back two very helpful reviews, and one review that in toto read, Hull is a specious mountebank.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure.
Well, I had to look it up and do a little analysis, conceptual analysis, and I was able to respond to the other two reviewers, but I really wanted to respond to this, and I puzzled about it, and finally I wrote the editor, and he said, "I'm very glad to have been identified as a specious mountebank. I would hate to be a real one." And that the article was accepted and published.
Yeah. Yeah, and usually the editor,
editor
is the one that is negotiating those changes. Sometimes they send it back to the people, but often I think the editor is, you know, they're trying to move things along. And particularly if there's a new journal, you know, if they want it for, you know, I've had it where they're like, have you made your revisions yet? Have you made your revisions yet? Have you made your revisions? Because they're looking to put it in, they see a slot for it a couple of months down the road. And when that happens, you know they're going to publish it. You just know they will. But you just, you know, you do have to make your revisions. Yeah.
How do you identify a journal in terms of its prestige if you're not going around asking professors and so forth? How do you identify A-list and B-list journals? What kinds of analytical things are available for authors to evaluate journals in terms of a term that I've recently learned about, impact factor? What the heck is that?
That's me. Okay. Well, actually, who knows what impact factor is? Oh, good. She can tell you. Yeah, because I'm not real clear about what exactly that is. But
she's looking it up.
Oh, good. That's good.
In Google.
I mean, I think it's an even harder question in the humanities where we don't do that. The question is, you know, how do you evaluate what's a good journal? And I think the answer is you do it by talking to people.
Peers. And then I would do which I'm going to talk about tomorrow in my session, a TSA, something I made up called a text structure analysis or discourse analysis, you'd call it in English, where you actually pull out what are the key elements in that journal article, how is it structured, and how much time do they spend, particularly on methods. Usually your top journals will have a lot of time spent on methods because the work is supposed to be replicable. And if you haven't spent a lot of time, if there isn't a lot of attention paid to methods, it may not be, that's one of the ways, a top-tier journal. The other is the titles will not be friendly or jazzy. They will say all the pieces, the effect of the study on middle school students, motivation and awareness in the science classroom. I mean, they'll have everything, all the pieces of whatever is in the article will be in the title. So there's a lot of ways to just look at the structure of the article and figure out at which level it is, to me anyway. Go ahead. Impact.
Oh, okay. So an impact factor is basically when a lot of people cite from that journal. Yeah, from that journal. And we use that a lot in health education, and the more that you publish in a high impact factor journal, the better it is for you because you get promoted, and then better for your division and your department. So a really big impact factor journal would in health education would be the American, or no, the Journal of Public Health Education. And then also, if you get published in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, that's a huge, huge deal because so many people read that and cite from that journal. And so that's what an impact factor is.
The comments?
Laura Frost. Hi. I was just going to add to that that if your impact factor is less than one, then nobody's really reading that journal.
Mm. And you know, that's a big difference between journal publishing and book publishing, which is that, you know, journals, nobody's buying the journal just for your article, right? So you can write an article that doesn't have much of an audience, right, as long as the journal editor accepts it. But it's really different for books. You know, for books, and I think, and I hope Helen Sword's book is going to help to change this, because I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. You know, I think that, in fact, in the Chronicle just recently, there was a quote by the editor of Public Culture, which has been one of those, you know, tragically hip journals that's, you know, all high theory and basically often unreadable. And he said, you know, I want to change that, and I want to publish articles that are engaging and informative and basically fun to read. And so, I think what's going to happen is, and in another thing, you know, she talks about is having titles that are actually appealing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having so I think it's a both and that you don't have to just because the journal has, you know, typically a bunch of pieces that are stodgy and jargon laden. You don't have to write that way, and in fact, it might be a real relief for an editor to get something that's where the author pays attention to the. To the prose. And for books, you absolutely have to do that. You don't have a captive readership. The library market has, you know, pretty much dried up. When I was an editor, you know, people used to talk about, you know, the standing orders that libraries had with Oxford University Press. And a gazillion years ago, Oxford did have standing orders. from different libraries, and not anymore. You know, so you couldn't count on selling, you know, 750 copies of every book to a library. So that means that the burden is now on the author to write a book that people actually want to read. And so I think, you know, I think taking that mindset into the journal publishing so that when you write an article, you really think about, you know, writing something that people are going to read is only going to help our profession in general.
Are there things I can do to acquire insight into the point of view or the practice of reviewing as a potential author? Are there some things I can do to learn more about reviewing from that point of view and thus turn that around to improve my own performance as a writer?
There's... Well, you can do peer reviews with fellow, if you're in graduate school, with fellow students of papers and give each other feedback in the beginning. And just read each other's papers. If your faculty let you do that, then it's a really, really good thing to do. I see nodding over there with a doctoral student, right? And that, because that's an audience. You get somebody to read your work. The other thing is to volunteer to review conference papers. Conferences are always looking in one of your big conferences in your division or in your special interest group. Volunteer as a reviewer. They're often looking, and sometimes they don't know who they're getting to review. Sometimes they do. I'm in the Action Research SIG special interest group at AERA. I was the program chair for the last 3 years. And I had 24 people reviewing papers for that SIG special interest group. And so that you get to read the work that's being done now. I am a reviewer for a journal, and I had a doctoral student. If you have a faculty member who is reviewing for a journal, ask that faculty member if you can read some of the papers that are sent to them for review. And you volunteer. So a lot of it is volunteering to get the experience as a reviewer. And then give the faculty member some of that, of your advice, and then they can match. Yeah. I see nods over there. Because that's any time you can get an opportunity to read other people's work, think about it, and offer comment.
Also, as a faculty member, if you have your own students and journals are asking you to review a bunch of things and you just don't have time to review all of them, I have on a number of occasions suggested that my former students review them and tell the journal that so-and-so is my former student and or my current student for that matter. And one of my former students is now an associate professor at University of Texas at Austin. He is on editorial boards for at least two journals now because I told the journals that he should be able to that I would like
for him
to be
a reviewer. And if you're on the editorial board, that's one level, but you can also be reviewing for that journal and not be on the editorial board. I have a couple of journals I do that for too. Yeah. So any opportunity you get to read people's work, think about it, reflect on it. If you feel unsure about that, find another peer, another student you can talk to about it, or another faculty member. But yeah.
Actually, this is a question that I have, because I was, and this might be different from your perspective, but, I wonder, we all have such, I feel like this is me, limited time and intellectual energy. And so, I like things to count. What I do, I want it to count. And so there are things that we're expected to do as members of the profession, like manuscript reviews. If an editor from a press calls me up and says, will you do a review of this manuscript, usually I just want to say no. I want to do my own work. But, it's one of the things that we do. I think writing book reviews is kind of in that category, that it's a service to the profession. But I've seen some of my friends, in graduate school spend time writing book reviews, sometimes because their, advisors don't have the time to do it. And I think, is that the best use of your time? I think it does develop a certain kind of analytical skill, but I'm not sure that the publications count the way that finishing the thesis would count or doing a journal article. So I think it's always a balance. And for me, I think the most useful thing that I've seen people do is form writing groups. where you do practice all those skills on each other's work, and that you also are reading across disciplines and you're writing for people across disciplines. But I mean, I don't know what you guys think about whether or not that's a good use of, you know, limited time. I mean, it's really important for the profession as long as we continue to have reviews.
Book reviews. I have my doc students in one of my classes write a book review, and we do it. We do the text structure analysis thing that I like to do, and we have them because they're going to read the book anyway for their dissertation. If they're reading the book anyway, it's on their shelf, and they go, I need to read this book for my dissertation, then I say, okay, why don't you write a review? And some of the reviews aren't very long, 700, 900 words. So they feel really, really good, and they're starting in the publication process. They have a line on their CV of a publication. And later on, you know, book reviews don't count very much when you go up for promotion. But it does show that you're participating in the publication process, right? And that you're beginning to go out there, put your stuff out there, and see what happens to it. Yeah.
Should I be working on several projects at once? And if so, how do I keep on top of all of them?
30 seconds. Is that all the time?
Yes.
Really? We're fast.
And I don't know. I mean, I think this is one of those questions, like, what time of day should you write? You know, should you write in the morning or should you write at night? Should you write, you know, when you're drinking, or should you write in a quiet room? And I think, you know, people work differently. And, you know, so what I know about myself is, you know, I like to focus on different things. And I also really need time after I write something to put it away. And so when I'm spending that time away from something, then I'm starting something new. I think with different kinds of projects, you can't do that, or it's a luxury. So with short-form things, you can do that. With articles, you can do that. With books, you know, I don't know that you have the luxury to put it away and work on something different. But I think that...
Sometimes you have to.
Sorry?
Sometimes you have to. You know, you have to put it away and do something. When you're really, at least I do. I think part of the challenge of being an academic is an organizational challenge. Is you have to spend time reflecting and managing. I mean, those who write textbooks know that, and any book is managing your time and figuring out how you're going to allocate the limited time you have to make it work for you. I usually work on I have a 6-month like schedule and a goal, and then I go backwards from that goal and figure out what I need to do each month, and I kind of just monitor my progress towards those larger goals, and I'm pretty systematic about it because I want to do a lot of stuff, and if I don't manage my time and really set aside time for writing, I don't write. So I have to, you know, and all of the research on academic writing from Robert Boyce to other people is that you need to have what are called Robert Boyce, who's done 30 years of research on academic productivity, says that you have to have BDS, brief daily sessions. Brief daily sessions, at the very least, to do academic writing.
And I think, I mean, you have, and you have to treat that part of the job as a job in and of itself.
That's right.
You know, and for me, I used to think it was butt in the chair time, you know, that I had to sit in front of my computer for, you know, at least 2 hours every day and write. And then what I realized is sometimes, you know, when I was writing, I was really, like, you know, emailing, or I was, you know, looking at Facebook. Not that I would look at Facebook, but and so I realized I wasn't. I mean, I was. It looked like I was working, but I wasn't really working. You know, so for things like deadlines, I find enormously useful. If you're writing with other people, so if there's a group and you're accountable to actually get something in, that helps. And then for me, like, I started imposing on myself a daily word quota. And, you know, I used to really scoff at that idea. And I realized it's so useful. And if you set the bar kind of low, so for me, like last summer, I said 500 words a day, well, except on weekends, cause, you know, I needed a break. But 500, and I would always exceed it. And they wouldn't necessarily be 500 good words.
No.
You know, I mean, that, and that's the thing. But at the end of the summer, I had a whole bunch of work done And then I would, in the afternoons, I would do research, you know, so that I'd have something to write about the next morning. But I think, you know, to me, it's really, I was conflating butt in the chair time with actually productive time. And I think that was a big, and I'm fairly productive as a writer, but I think that was a big switch for me to realize, oh, discernible, you know, goals, things that you can actually really say. So I think looking 6 months in advance, figuring out what you have to do, where you want to get, is really useful.
Thank you.
I've heard someone express it this way. They said there's a distinction between the zone of productivity and the zone of pretense.
And speaking of Vygotsky, the zone.
This raises also a question about you've got a favorable review. There's some suggestions for revisions. You've done those. You send in your revised manuscript. What do I expect next? What are my responsibilities after that point? I'm talking proofreading. I'm talking marketing. I'm talking.
Oh my God, that's when the work starts.
All of those kinds of things. What happens? What do I have to do next?
You mean, are you talking about a book or a journal?
Either
article?
Books or articles. Does the concept of marketing apply to articles?
Books, yeah.
You wait for the applause. I mean, I think this is one thing that that I've been thinking a lot about is how little recognition we get for how much work we really put into stuff. You know, so if you publish an article, like really, like. What can you expect? Can you expect a letter from your dean saying, you know, you go, girl? You know, or, you know, the president of the university is going to call you up and say, that was great. You know, can you put on Facebook, like, hey, you know what, I published an article today. And then, like, having your friends say like is kind of, that's kind of a lot, you know, to get that kind of approval. And I think one of the things that makes academics so nutty, and if you don't think that we're nutty, you're, you know, fortunate, but I think we don't get a lot of props in our lives, and I think one of the hardest things for academic book authors is, you know, you get a publication date, you know, and that's, you know, 6 weeks after the book actually comes out, and so, you know, you do all of this work, and it takes years, and it's really, really hard, and then, you know, then you go through, after the manuscript is accepted, you have to review the copied manuscript, you know, which is a pain in the butt. And then you have to, you know, proofread, which is really a pain in the butt. And God forbid you have to write an index. And there are all these things. You have to do the author's questionnaire, which is, how are we going to market this sucker once it's out there in the world? And then, you know, you get the bound book, and that's exciting, right? Because there's this physical thing that you made. I made that. And then, you know, so for my first book, the publication date was September 9th. And I was on the Today Show in August, and it was really cool, you know. And I'm like, oh, I can't wait for my publication date. It was September 9th, 2001. So, you know, the book came out, and then nobody wanted to talk about anything, you know.
Anything after
anything. But I think what happens for academic authors is the publication date comes and nothing happens. Nothing happens. You know, maybe, you know, you'll get taken out to dinner, or somebody will throw a book party for you, and your friends will come, and your colleagues will come. But then you have to wait months and months, and sometimes years, for somebody to notice, for reviews.
Well, you do get book reviews, you know, and that happens.
For academic books, it can take 18 months,
yes,
right, for a book
to be
reviewed.
When I wrote the journal keeping book and I got the manuscript, I remember very clearly putting it on my kitchen table. I mean, this is not a public recognition. But I put it there, and I went, yes. I mean, it just was, it was like, oh, you know. And during the whole time, it was delayed a couple of years. My mother was sick, and, you know, all these things happen in your life. You know, she died, and then, you know, I'm still trying to do this manuscript, but it was part of my heart. It was really an important part of my work. And it was just this tremendous feeling of satisfaction of having a book. And And it's doing fine. It's doing fine, which is good. It's going to be reprinted again in September. So that, you know, it's fine. And so that's, and I've gotten really good reviews in Amazon and, you know, academic reviews as well. So that's very nice too. And there is a feeling of a great accomplishment when you have a book.
And I guess my point is, you know, that, you know, that's, you know, the best case scenario. But I think that the reason that writing groups can be so useful is because then everybody is invested in your success, you know, and your success becomes their success.
That's
because
nice.
It's really, you know, hard and lonely to do this, especially when, you know, and if you get reviews in the best journal in your field, you know, that's great. It's the approbation of your peers. But I think, you know, if you're waiting 18 months and you've heard nothing, you know, during those 18 months, you're working on something else, you know, and it's hard to get the energy to keep going on something. And we're all self-motivated. But I think bringing in, you know, other people into the process so you feel like you're in conversation with the community is really, I mean, the writing groups that I've seen that are successful, you know, there was a group at Duke of for English professors, and they all published not only books, but books that were trade books that sold really well and got great reviews. And they basically, you know, said couldn't have done it without them. So I would just encourage you to do that if you can find a bunch of people.
And I want to just take a moment to speak in support of self-aggrandizement with articles, too, that when you publish an article, it seems to me there's a lot of audiences that you might want to have learn about that might not otherwise. I'm not talking about your dean and your provost. I'm talking about
that's an interesting idea.
I'm talking about the people whose discussion section might have included something that said, gee, more research is needed on blah, 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 and you're one of those blah, blah, blahs.
Oh, nice.
And especially if that person is a big name in your field, to let them know.
I'd like to
I'm
let you know.
I'm talking about
just
someone.
Yes, article.
Exactly.
Yeah, great.
And even
great.
If it wasn't that kind of connection, just the people who are in your bibliography, who you have respect for, and who did anything that's at all resembling what you've come up with, just to show you that this
idea.
Is
that
how
idea.
You've affected my work. And in textbooks, too. I won't say I believe in what I do, but I do it anyway. And that's that from time to time, I find myself very consciously citing with approval, because I approved of it, not because it's a marketing thing, a work that's done by someone who, gee, I would like to have noticed this textbook compared to the competing textbooks, because we all know that we are egos, and if they can see that their students can see that they've been quoted with authority whatever it might be being quoted with, that can count towards an adoption.
And I think, I mean, the idea, that's exactly the idea, is that you're writing in conversation with the people that you most admire and respect.
Or need,
yeah. And I think, I mean, social media has really been, I think, a great thing in lots of ways. And, you know, lots of my friends are constantly, you know, posting links to things they've written, and it's great because I wouldn't have seen them otherwise. And then that circle, and it's, you know, sometimes it can be uncomfortable to feel like you're, you know, please click like, because, you know, I did this. But I think getting the word out and being in conversation with people is really essential.
We have time for a few more questions. Anybody got a burning issue? The one other thing I would want to emphasize, and it kind of relates in some ways to Danielle's story about how great it feels to see that bound volume. My first book, I got it, and I was so excited. It was hardbound, and it was slick, and it looked so good, and the paper felt so good, and I opened it up, and it opened up to a page where the first thing I saw was a typo. And the typo was PP dot in the middle of a word.
Oh.
Couldn't conceive how that happened. I still can't conceive how it happened. And so that raises the point I wanted to make of the importance of proofreading. How do you recommend that you see to it that your work is adequately proofread by, well, the adequately, I think, tells the story. How many pairs of eyes, how many times through, do you recommend reading from the rear to the front? I mean, how do you, what techniques and tricks are there for proofreading your own work or having others proofread your work?
Well, I when I proofread with a ruler so that I'm going down the page, and so I'm not doing fast reading. I'm doing very slow reading so that the ruler's red. I mean, I have this method. And so that I can make sure that I'm slowly, that's the way I do it. That's one way to do it. And I, of course, more eyes, the better. If you can get people to help you with your proofreading, it's important. What do you think?
And I'm a terrible proofreader, and I also am such an obsessive reviser that I basically have memorized, you know, much of the prose. And so I read right over things that are, you know, like, oh, that's, right. You know. And, you know, it's funny when I have students read their writing in class, you know, it's interesting. Often they will read something that's not written because it's the way they read it is right. You know, they know that it's right, but they haven't actually paid attention to the fact that what they've written is wrong. And so, honestly, I have other people do it. I have other people do it. And, you know, and I don't cook, so it's not like I can cook them a meal or something. But I find some way to repay them because it's a big favor. Because it's a favor because they're not reading it for any kind of pleasure or content.
And they haven't written it, which is probably good.
And they haven't
written it, then sometimes it's right. Not easy to see when the problems are.
Yeah, in added to tricks of proofreading, I read somewhere someone did a study on changing the font, like changing it from 12 to 28, and then reading it that way, and you see a lot of things jump out that you wouldn't see ordinarily.
Did that help?
Yes.
Well, I did that. I actually just wrote a column about this because sometimes, like, I trick myself into, like, feel like I'm writing more in a different voice or fresh by using a different font, you know, like, because I think if something looks unfamiliar, and actually somebody else just did a column you know, on this, to that exact study, that I think that can be really useful. And also, when a book comes to you in page proof, you know, it looks like a different thing from what your manuscript looks like. But it's still, you know, I think, you know, you have that pride of author. It's hard. It's just, I think it's just hard to do it yourself. So, you know, if you can't cook for somebody, you pay them or you offer to mow their lawn or walk their dog or something.
Well, I think we've burned through our hour. Thank you all very much for coming, and let's thank our two discussants.
Brainstorming Academic Publishing is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.